This is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com. Joining me on the line today is Eagle Strongvoice, a.k.a. Kevin Annett, a human rights activist who has spent 15 years campaigning to bring justice to the churches and governments responsible for genocide in Canada's Indian residential schools. He's the author of Hidden from History, The Canadian Holocaust, and the producer of the award-winning documentary Unrepentant, Kevin Annett and Canada's Genocide. Mr. Annett, thank you very much for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Thank you.
Well, first off today, I'd like to quote from a press release that was released on the Hidden from History website at hiddenfromhistory.org on the 10th of January, 2010. Human rights activist Kevin Annett assaulted in Vancouver. Reverend Kevin Annett was assaulted by two men in Vancouver's downtown east side last Wednesday, just 2 days after he published an article on church and government complicity in child trafficking on Canada's west coast. Let's get the latest information on this, and firstly, are you okay? And secondly, can you flesh out the background to this story?
Yeah, I'm doing fine now. I suffered a cracked rib and some bruises. Fortunately, it was quick. The people didn't rob me. It was just a sudden assault, the kind of thing that's happened now and then to me. But like I say, it did happen very soon, a couple of days after an article came out, and it was widely distributed all over that part of Vancouver. The downtown area, and it basically showed that over about 10 years now, I've been part of a group that's been documenting how the child trafficking that even UNESCO commented on back in the 1990s, how Vancouver is kind of a hub in that whole system in the Pacific Rim. That this information we published, and we're talking about the links between some of the police, church officials and government who seem to be involved in some way in this this network. So that came out, and in a way it didn't surprise me because I often say to people, well, the good thing about these things is it shows you're still on the right track, because why else would somebody respond in that way? The reason I know the physical attack wasn't isolated or something else is because it was accompanied by a whole new series of smears and other things designed to try to derail the work we're doing. Several of the people we've been being involved with have actually been arrested in the period prior to the Olympics here in Vancouver. There's a lot of police harassment of community activists. And time and again, these people are asked questions like, well, are you involved with Kevin Annett? Are you investigating the Vancouver Club? Are you looking into the links between the police and these child porn networks and that? So there's a lot of focus on that that's happening now, and I think it's certainly related to this longer-term campaign we're doing, which is not just about the Indian residential schools, but how these crimes continue today.
Well, that is very interesting. Well, tell us about that longer-term campaign and what it is you're trying to expose.
Well, for me, about 15 years ago, when I first began to seriously document what had gone on in the Indian boarding schools, it was a relatively kind of, for me at the time, an isolated issue. I thought this was some kind of aberration. The way the media continued, the mainstream media tend to portray this issue as, well, this was the result of a few bad priests or nuns. And the system as a whole has acknowledged this and has apologized. The Prime Minister of Canada got up in the Parliament last year and made reference to how bad it was that children had disappeared like this. Unfortunately, for me, anyone who gets involved in this work after a while, you realize that it isn't isolated. It's part of a whole condition facing Native people and others who are marginalized in Canada and the U.S., where they're basically an underclass, and they don't have the same kinds of rights that citizens do. And the genocide that occurred that really, for example, depopulated about 90% of the Native population here on the West Coast, it's carrying on today in a very high death rate in the random killing of Native people by police, the continued depopulation of whole areas of northern B.C. More and more of the people I work with who are homeless in Vancouver have lost their land. They're being forced off their land because of deals signed between their chiefs and large multinationals to get the resources, and especially the water and the hydroelectric power. And so this is, as in any third world society, you see the same pattern of migration into the inner core of cities by people who have been made landless. It's the same kind of destruction of their way of life and their culture that has gone on for centuries, really, here on this continent. So I realize that this isn't just something that happened, can be cured with a few dollars and a verbal apology, which really means nothing in practice. what we need to do is to hold the institutions accountable. We have to bring them to trial, and we have to stop this whole condition of genocide and violence that's aimed consistently against Native people and others. So it was kind of a gradual awakening for me, and the increasingly kind of paranoid reaction by the institutions we're talking about, and their defensiveness and their refusal to do something like even return the remains of the children who died in these residential schools. All of this indicates that they've got a lot to hide still, and the full truth of this still hasn't even really begun to come out.
Well, I certainly can see the gulf between what it is you're trying to achieve and what the reality on the ground is, and that's unfortunate, but I think that indicates that, I guess, it's still a long way off before the Canadians can begin to look at this genocide. So what progress have you seen in recent years, or what things have you managed to achieve in your campaign?
Well, it's kind of paradoxical because while it's true, the institutions are still as much in denial and still as guilty of these things as ever. On the ground, you've seen quite an amazing transformation. I've seen in 10 years a real corner turned in terms of the awareness of people about these crimes, their willingness to hold their own society accountable, especially among younger people. When I speak in colleges and on Aboriginal reserves, a real willingness, even a militancy on their part to confront the system that continues to kill them off, if you like. And among kind of ordinary Canadians, a much greater awareness and, to give an example, whenever we hold rallies or vigils outside churches, most of the people who go into those churches now are quite in support of what we're doing. It wasn't that case 10 years ago. There was just quite an abysmal level of ignorance about this stuff. But now that some of the mainstream media, like the Globe and Mail newspaper in Toronto, the largest newspaper in Canada, 2 years ago they began to, for the first time, print some of the evidence that I had been circulating for 10 years, which involved a very high death rate in these residential schools, the fact that half the children died there. And the fact that the Globe and Mail is talking about that finally, that half the children die in a school, that means that it's not something you can bury anymore. It's out there. It's beginning to be talked about much more widely, and eventually it'll enter the school curriculum, because that's one of the things we're trying to do. Actually get the history books changed so it begins to reflect the true reality of this country.
Well, those are some exciting developments, but I guess situating it in the context of today, in that recent press release, you implicated the 2010 Olympic Security Forces as part of the force behind the attack against you. And for people who don't know about the police state that Vancouver is becoming ahead of the 2010 Games, can you paint the picture for us and tell us what's happening on the ground there these days?
Well, it's really bad. It's basically the society, the whole area of Vancouver is being militarized. And you have martial law being declared. You have regular police sweeps where homeless people and natives especially are targeted and are put in paddy wagons and taken away without any charges laid. They have the power now to do that. Security cameras everywhere. In one day, I counted 54 different cameras that I was under surveillance from in the downtown part of Vancouver. And these cameras are going to stay after the Olympics. You have the fact that there's going to be 4,000 Canadian soldiers patrolling this area during the Olympics. That's more troops than there are in Afghanistan from Canada. And, it's a whole climate of repression. By the security forces, there's an integrated security unit which involves the Vancouver Police, the RCMP, private security companies, and they have the power to go into homes. They've knocked on the doors of activists. They've threatened them with jail unless they answer their questions about, a lot of details about what they're doing and who they're associated with. It's just that kind of continual harassment. And, it indicates a real, something more than just Olympic security. It's almost like they're using this as a test case or something to see how much, I think to some degree, to see how much people are willing to tolerate on the ground.
Well, I think that's right. This must be some sort of test of what people are willing to put up with. And I guess the ultimate test of the people of Vancouver and the people of Canada really is to what extent they'll oppose these measures. But I imagine that there must be some backlash on the ground there. What's the sense of the people there about these measures?
There's a lot of cynicism about it. I found very few people who are even very that excited about the games, the Olympic Games, because it's operating under the shroud of repression and corruption. I mean, for me, the epitome of that is the official supplier for food to the 2010 Olympics is McDonald's, if you can believe it. There's all these pictures of Olympic athletes holding junk food, you know, fries and hamburgers. I mean, that's a great diet to be on when you're an Olympic athlete. But it's just all about corporate sponsorship and big bucks. And I think everyone's aware of that, even the mainstream media talk in those terms. So, but in terms of the police state kind of measures, there was a protest the other day of hundreds of people in downtown Vancouver. And these aren't just the typical, you know, stereotypical activists, young people. These are like older people, all kind of a cross section of society, people who are very concerned and alarmed about the changes happening here. So, you know, I'm like with this work on residential schools, I see kind of a new awakening happening among people. There isn't this automatic compliance that you would assume, you know.
Well, just to put those changes into perspective for people, what really is the regulations against deploying the Canadian military? Does there have to be some kind of official declaration of martial law in order for that to take place?
No, Canada is not like the U.S. You know, it didn't have this posse comitatus law about prohibiting the use of soldiers on domestic soil. Canada's never had that tradition of holding the military in check. We've always been a colonial society. So there's, you know, when the War Measures Act was announced in 1970, for example, it didn't even need an act of parliament. Most of the laws in Canada aren't even passed in parliament. They're done what's called through order in council. So the Privy Council, which is this old colonial body from London, it's the Prime Minister and his cabinet and the Governor General and a few civil servants. They sit down and drop the laws. They can pass these laws. It's never debated before a legislature. We've always lived under that kind of quasi-police state in Canada. And so in a way, a lot of these things, as shocking as they are to maybe middle-class people who have never faced that kind of repression, it's always been the norm for Canada to operate this way. So, you know, and something like this is a way for people to learn the true nature of what they're living under, I think.
Well, I understand that there will be a number of political protests during the Olympics, and some of them, for example, are being organized by the Friends and Relatives of the Disappeared. For the listeners who may not know about that organization, tell us what it is and specifically what's being planned for the Olympics.
Well, it's a network across Canada. Our two main groups are in Toronto and Vancouver, and we're a group of Native and non-Native people who are relatives or friends of people who've been through Indian residential schools and people who died there. And we, for about 4 years now, we've been holding pretty high-profile occupations of churches, protests, occupations of government offices to demand that the children's remains be returned for proper burial, the over 50,000 children who died in residential schools, that the churches be held accountable, the Catholic, the Anglican, the United Churches, be brought to trial for something that is pure out-and-out genocide. And we are one of the things we're hoping to do during the Olympics, because there'll be literally thousands of reporters here from all over the world. We want to do some, again, public and high-profile protests that are going to draw the media so that we can begin to speak to them about not just the crimes of the past, but how these crimes are continuing, the condition of Native people today, and, you know, holding these groups accountable for what's gone on. So we're hoping to do that during the Olympics, during mid to late February, and, you know, reaching out in that way.
Well, what is the overall sense among Natives about the games, and are other groups taking part in these, or is it just the Friends and Relatives of the Disappeared?
Oh, there's a lot of community groups that are going to be taking part. We're part of a whole network of anti-Olympic groups, the Women's Center in the Downtown East Side, community advocacy groups, some of the unions. You know, we're all involved together and working on this. And I forgot the first part of your question.
Sense among Native communities is sort of...
Oh, overall. The Native people, Native response, yes. Very split. The government-funded Native chiefs are all in favor of the Olympics. They're talking about how it's creating job opportunities, which is nonsense. I mean, very few Native people are ever hired anywhere, and those that are at the Olympics are at minimum wage jobs that are going to be gone in 2 weeks. So it's, you know, they've received big bucks from the government to do what they do, which is to get all the Native people on board to help the government. But on the ground, a lot of the Native people who aren't tied into the government money system, into the band council system, They're the ones who are the most outspoken against the Olympics. I mean, for example, the Squamish people whose land the Olympics are on, there was a lot of blockades of the Sea to Sky Highway when it was under construction. And there were a lot of arrests, you know, mostly of Native people who were trying to block that highway. So, you know, this is something that on the ground there's a lot of opposition to.
Well, then, broadening our scope here a little bit, tell us about your plans for the upcoming year and what you hope to accomplish.
Well, we're hoping to do, to follow up from something that really significant that happened last October. I was invited over to Europe, and I went for 3 weeks to Italy, Ireland, and England to give a lot of lectures and to meet with other groups of survivors of especially the Catholic school and their orphanages. You probably, in the States, you've heard, got a lot of media coverage actually on what's going on in Ireland now with all of the revelation after the Ryan report was released. The Pope himself is implicated in trying to cover up these decades-long atrocities being done against children in Catholic orphanages and in churches. And so I was invited especially to Italy by some human rights groups there. And on October 11th, I held a ceremony in right in St. Peter's Square opposite the Vatican, right actually after the Pope had given his Sunday speech to the crowd. And there weren't actually that many people there listening to him, maybe a couple of hundred. But I was set up there. We did a service in memory of the children who died in Catholic schools. It was covered very widely in Italian newspapers, and it was kind of ironic because the next morning a major tornado hit Rome for the first time in 40 years, and maybe that or what I did shook something loose, because I got the people I worked with got a phone call 2 days later from a fairly senior cardinal in the Vatican who finally responded to a letter we had sent the Vatican a year ago, which was more than a year ago, which demanded, as I mentioned, that the church start returning the remains of these children who had died for proper burial. And he said that in the future when I come back that he would be willing to talk to a delegation about this whole thing. So as much as that's probably just politics and face-saving on their part, it shows you that if, you know, this whole campaign has reached a certain critical mass where even the Vatican feels they have to respond in some way. And so my plan for the coming year is in late March, I'm going back to Europe for a month or two and speaking all over Europe now, and we even have a meeting with the European Parliament, who are considering doing an investigation into this genocide. And if we can start kind of a tourism and trade boycott of Canada and getting other countries to support an international war crimes tribunal into these crimes of genocide, both in the U.S. and Canada, then, this will have reached a new level. And that's, as I always knew, we had to get outside the country for it to begin to get other support. And, the European media was fantastic. I was on national radio in Ireland. All the papers were covering this stuff. And we even had city governments in Italy endorsing our campaign. And that's something we've never received in North America.
That is incredible and very exciting news. Well, tell us about the trip and some of the stories that you heard from various people there.
In Europe?
Yes.
There was actually a lot of awareness, much more awareness than you get among Canadians or Americans about the genocide of Native people here in their own country. To give an example of that, I was in a small town in northern Italy, and I was invited to speak in a church, a small Protestant church. Actually, the people there seemed to have an intuitive knowledge of what I was talking about, because for centuries they had suffered a lot of persecution at the hands of the Catholic Church, had been almost wiped out. And my own ancestors had come from France. They were Huguenot dissenters who had to flee to England, because of persecution by the Vatican. And I realized, you know, standing there talking to these people, that this is, for the first time, I mean, I had a sense that this was my story, too, that this had happened to my people. That's why so many of us came to North America, to get away from that kind of persecution. And so really, I felt a new kind of bond with the whole struggle. It wasn't just about Native people, but it's about this kind of persecution done against so many people around the world. Simply, the idea behind genocide is basically you become like us or you die. And that's certainly has been played out in Europe for many centuries at the hands of the church. So it was very invigorating for me to have people come up and say, this is our story too, and we're really behind you, and what can we do for you? It just means a lot to meet people in other countries who, come forward and do that.
Well, as I say, that's very exciting to hear the solidarity and support now crossing international lines. That's a great development. Well, tell us about the Hidden from History website and what kinds of things people can find there.
Well, there's been some new developments. Our website is www.hiddenfromhistory.org, and on there you can find our film Unrepentant. That's a documentary we did a few years ago. It's won a number of awards now, including in the Los Angeles and New York Independent Film Festivals as the best documentary. And on it, you find a lot of the evidence. We have oral testimonies of people who survived this genocide, people who were sterilized in these Indian hospitals. A lot of the history, especially if you look under updates on the right-hand column, you'll see a lot of the recent work we do. But on the site as well, there's a link to a feature film we completed recently called The Diary. And it's a feature film based loosely on my story, and it's about a little girl. It's kind of like the Anne Frank story brought to North America, because it's about a little Native girl who keeps a diary when she's incarcerated in one of these residential schools, and she dies there. She's killed. But this white minister discovers the diary, you know, years later, and has to ask some questions about, well, what do I do with this now? And it really overturns his life and starts bringing this truth out more. So it was quite something to be part of the making of that, and there's a trailer to that on our website. So those are the kinds of developments that really we're hoping more and more people will learn about. And even at the level of just telling your local librarian and people at colleges about the website, one of the ways that I survive is by, I'm on the, one of the ways I've survived the blacklisting over the last 12 years has been to do the campus lecture circuit. And that's one of the ways that this keeps going, just by getting out there and talking about this. So again, that's hiddenfromhistory.org, and just, you know, spread the information around.
And if there are listeners out there that are interested in supporting you and your efforts, what's the best way they can do that?
Well, by spreading that information. Also, by one of the things we're doing is, when I return to Europe in March and April, I want to bring two survivors of the residential school with me, a man and a woman, both of whom went through terrible things, but also are very good public speakers who have been really instrumental to our work. We're trying to raise the airfare to get them over to Europe with us. So we need contributions now, and you can write me directly at hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca, and my phone number is 250-753-3345.
All right, excellent. Well, Mr. Nett, it's very good, as always, talking with you, and I certainly hope you can come back on after the Olympics and give us some updates about how things went. But
I sure will.
Excellent. Well, please take care, and please continue doing what you're doing. Thank you very much for joining me on the Corporate Report today.
Thanks, James.